A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
With a massive move to distributed data architecture, it's essential to have access to all of your data wherever it is. A data mesh emphasizes domain-driven data ownership, data as a product, self-service infrastructure, and federated computational governance, giving you faster time to value without needing to transport your data. Starburst allows you to achieve this distributed architecture by allowing you to run SQL queries across distributed data that connect sources, regions, and clouds. For more information on how your team can benefit from a data mesh strategy, check out our Data Mesh Resource Center on our website.
Data Mesh Radio is provided as a free community resource from DataStax. Welcome to Data Mesh Radio, produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. Data Mesh Radio is a vendor-independent resource for learning more about Data Mesh. Let's jump in. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Marius Inger, a developer turned consultant who has been working with a few clients on implementing Data Mesh at his extremely Norwegian named company, Nurkafrit AS. We covered three distinct topics: evaluating if Data Mesh is a fit for your organization, team structure challenges in Data Mesh, or data mesh-like implementations, and just what the heck is federated computational governance. On evaluating if data mesh is right for you, there is the common answer of look at your company size and the number/complexity of your domain. If you aren't big and don't have complex domains, data mesh is going to be overkill. Where exactly that line starts to cross as to how big and how many domains and how complex they have to be, it gets a little fuzzy, but really it's kind of measuring what's really causing any data problems you're seeing. And yes, every company wants to get to sharing data, but the centralized data team isn't the bottleneck yet for a lot of companies. Centralization can add a lot of value until it starts to become more hurtful than helpful. And yes, figuring out that point is easier said than done. Centralization of data does fight Conway's law and can become too much cognitive load as well. So kind of looking for those things is key. So back to measuring if data mesh is right for you, a key question is, what is the cost of allowing your data processes to fail? The business consequence of failed reports has historically not been all that high. But if you are driving business decisions, whether that is ML or just crucial day-to-day decisions on your data, data mesh might become more attractive because that cost of your data failing is significantly higher. Marius provided a great list of evaluation questions that can help you really evaluate your current state of where you are with data. If you feel comfortable with the answers, data mesh is probably not the solution to your current data woes. So those questions would be, how many data sets are you producing? What is the lead time to creating a new data set? How well are your data sets serving your data needs? How many domains do you have? How complex are those domains? How does the team respond to new data requirements? And how usable in general is your data? So again, there isn't a specific rubric. Bar Moses had provided one in one of her early posts on data mesh from kind of mid 2020. So if you want to go check that out, there's some good things in there around a rubric. But a lot of these questions are really like, what might be causing your data challenges? And is it really that this centralization is the problem? Second topic we covered was about team structure challenges in data mesh and data mesh-like implementations. In general, it's important to know that implementing data mesh will cause cultural challenges. Marius believes, and you know, this has been reiterated by a lot of folks, developers generally don't want to also have to share their data. It's additional work, so you have to align incentives, which is far easier said than done. The additional cognitive load on developer plates is really crucial to understand and to empathize with. We need to make sure we are aware of that to not burn them out. This means realigning those incentives again, but also having extra help doing things like grooming the backlog. Extra resources helps, but that is more about tackling the work, not handling the increased cognitive load. And learning about how to do data well is a pretty big learning task, honestly. Marius recommends giving teams the extra resources, but also reshape the team and business structure, such as the KPIs to effectively prioritize and shape your general requirements of what you want your teams to do. He also recommends having a stick, not just carrots, or teams will try to just opt out. Marius also made the point that if your team isn't well-structured already, a chaotic structure will make data mesh extremely difficult at best. He did talk about giving teams autonomy or agency or whatever when you think about how to actually structure your teams. And that, I think that's important as well, is to talk about what each team needs to provide as requirements and give them the resources to actually accomplish that, but kind of give them the ability to choose exactly how they want to do that. Jessitron in her interview also said a lot of the same things. We finished the conversation on the fun, quote unquote, topic of federated computational governance. It's a biggie, and when talking about it with developers right now, it feels far too complex. I think when talking about it with anybody, it kind of feels far too complex. We discussed some ways to make it less complex by reducing the friction to developer decisions, but not really adding much to their cognitive load. An example might be providing easy data masking tooling for PII or extensible data APIs so developers can focus on the value add instead of a lot of the nuts and bolts. Per Marius, when something like governance is too complex, developers will at best get it wrong and often try to skip it entirely. This is why shadow IT exists everywhere. So spend the time to make it much easier for developers. And developers need to understand the governance team is there as an enabler, not as just a set of rules to adhere to and a Confluence page. You know, it's that this is a team that's there to help instead of just put up gates that they have to go through.
With that bottom line up front done, let's go ahead and jump into this interview.
Very excited for today's episode. I've got Marius Ingerd. I think I murdered it again, but he's a consultant, kind of has more of a focus as a developer from a consulting perspective. And so we're going to talk about a lot of different topics, but a lot of this is helpful in understanding the developer mindset relative to data mesh and data challenges, because so much of where people are running into challenges are around the getting developer buy-in and explaining this to developers. Why should they care? Why does this matter? Et cetera, et cetera. So I think this is going to be very helpful for a lot of folks. And Marius is just a fun conversationalist as well. So I'm anticipating this being quite good. Marius, if you could give people a bit of an introduction to yourself and your background, including the company name, which I'm not even going to attempt at this point. But
yeah. Hello, everyone. My name is Marius. I'm 42 years old from Norway, married with children, I think you call it. The consultancy that I work for is called Knirkefritt. It's a very, very Norwegian name. We never intended for an English-speaking audience, so I guess that was our fault. It means something like smooth sailing. As Scott mentioned, I'm basically from the operational side of things. I usually do like the systems that become the sources for that analysis, right? So this is my kind of the last 1.5-2 years. I've been working with data mesh, so I've been looking at the data side of things, which is really interesting. And especially when you look at things like data mesh, when we're starting to integrate a lot of the thinking and tooling that's been on the operational side, on the analyst side.
Yeah, I think that whole concept of the self-serve platform, people get really bogged down in it, but it really is just like, I mean, you know, we had the NAB folks on that episode actually just released today. We had Bente Bush on a few weeks back, and then Audin and Joran from NAB, and they were just talking about so much of this is just, what are the workflows? Like what do developers expect from a platform perspective? So, so where we kind of wanted to jump off into is the evaluation of, is data mesh a good fit? And we were talking about, is data mesh a good fit for this organization, for this challenge, and even for this domain, right? They just had Scott Hawkins on from ITV, and he was talking about there are people, especially, but sometimes domains where you're trying to do it and it's just not working and it's not going to work. And that's okay. It's okay to kind of tap out to say, hey, we're not going to do that. So I think this, there is this little bit of a bias within the data mesh community that everybody should want to participate. Everybody should want to give their data, and everybody, you know, this is the best thing. And that, you know, if your data is useful, you must produce. And it's like, well, you've got to get them bought in. You got to do the incentivization. You've got to do all that stuff. So I think this is a really good topic. So if someone were to say, how do you think about, is this good for data mesh? Whichever you want to start at, the organization level, challenge, or the domain level, what would you go with?
I think I would start to look at the company size in terms of how big is the company, and of course the domain complexity. I mean, you have really simple domains which doesn't generate a lot of data, and you have very complex domains like healthcare systems and financing systems and insurance and all that stuff, really complex domains who generate a lot of data. So I guess from my perspective, if you have a small company with a simple domain, I wouldn't start off doing data mesh. I think like there's a lot of value into having a centralized team doing data. I mean, from my point of view, coming from the operational side of things, not having to think about those things is really neat, right? You have a lot of other stuff you have to focus on. You have to serve the front end. You have to model all your use cases, and you have consistency, and you have to scale and all that stuff. You have a lot of things to think about, right? Doing operational. So you really, if someone can kind of take off something which is kind of clean, which is a clean cut, that's good, right? So if you're coming from that side, I wouldn't start looking at data mesh. I think I would probably start looking at a platform. I don't think it's a good idea, or it doesn't take you a lot before it's valuable to separate the one team doing the ingestion from platform thinking. But besides doing that, I wouldn't like start to distribute things. It's a lot easier to, I mean, solve your governance model and all that stuff if you have one team. So, but again, that kind of beauty and the simplicity of having this one team kind of works only to a certain point, right?
Yeah.
You have things like Conway's law playing in. I mean, this team is probably going to create a monolithic architecture, right? Based on Conway, and of course, it doesn't scale. So if your data need starts to grow, things are going to look more and more complicated. You're going to have a larger and larger cognitive load on a single team, which they have to address more and more and more domains from. And actually, they don't even own the domains, right? They're like just man in the middle. you have the wall of confusion all over again, right? So if your domain starts to increase or your data needs starts to increase, and you have a complex domain, and also if you're large, then I think data mesh starts to add value. At least then it becomes an interesting proposition to look more into.
And where a lot of people in the data mesh space, I think, are coming at it from is that they are those smaller companies and they want to figure out how to actually effectively share their data. But I don't think that data mesh is overkill, right? You need to hammer in a nail, and you're trying to not just a sledgehammer, an actual jackhammer, right? Like something just massive that's not really built in that same way with that same concept. And so I don't know when you should start to say, hey, those domain teams need to be involved in sharing their data. I do think you were kind of saying that it's the more simplicity and the less that you have to think about that. I think that right now we don't have tooling to make that possible, right? So either you have just this data team that has to deal with kind of exhaust and that it's a bad situation.
Yeah.
But where we could really move and that it's a light cognitive load on the domain team is, hey, you're trying to evolve your application model. Like, let's talk about what this data model is for your domain, and that data model is created by that centralized team, and that it's managed, and that you as a developer have the tooling to understand that, okay, the application model has changed, or the application model needs to change in this way. Is that going to break our data model? And there's kind of that small amount of back and forth to say, can we still do this without it breaking our data model? But that it doesn't really slow down the application side to continue to evolve, allow that evolution.
Yeah, and you also have to consider what's the operational cost. I mean, what's the business consequence of allowing this to fail for a short period of time? Because if you have, I'm going to say back in the day, since I'm really old now, but I'm going to say back in the days. Usually analytical data was for reporting. And that was kind of the business consequence of having failed reports wasn't usually that big. So you could kind of accept that kind of, those kind of consequences, having a separate data team, like picking up the pieces and patching after or updating their ETL jobs and stuff like that. But I think one aspect we haven't talked about yet, which makes this more interesting, is that data-driven companies, they're starting to bridge the gap between the operational teams and the analytical side, in terms of you're starting to use analytical data to drive decisions in the operational domain. And when you start getting into that loop, the business consequences of having failed jobs starts to increase. And that's also a very strong argument to try to find a different model than a retroactive model. And the only way you can get proactive is to put the teams who are actually doing the changes and making them responsible for versioning and actually creating the data products. So I just wanted to throw that in there, that there's this really interesting axis in terms of what's the business criticality of having these data up to speed and online all the time.
Yeah, and I think the data folks, a lot of them say, okay, now we have the power to say, hey, application developers, you now have to do all of these things. And it's like, well, but you can't just throw more on their plate without the resourcing and the space to take on that additional cognitive load. And, Scott Hawkins' episode, he was talking about that for this to work, the incentivization, like go to their managers and not just be like, hey, your team needs to do this, but like, let's rework your team's KPIs. If you don't have that exec level buy-in to rework the KPIs and the OKRs and things like that, it's you're going to meet a ton of resistance. And that was kind of an aha moment where I was like, Yeah, you don't just go and say, hey, are you bought in? Let's go do this. It's like, hey, are you bought in? Let's enable you so that you can do this and that it's good for your team and your career to do this instead of that it's just a nice thing. And so
That's really interesting because I haven't heard that episode, but all the things you mentioned now are basically things that we are addressing at the one of my clients at the moment. It's this is a cultural problem. I mean, if you have a good fit for data mesh in terms of domain complexity and size and maybe how you decide to use data, you decide that, okay, we're going to do data mesh, then you're going to end up with a cultural problem because all those operational guys like me, they don't want to do this. I mean, they don't have the incentive to do this when you start off. So exactly like you said, you have to look at key performance indicators. You have to make the wins for them. Like if they expose their data, make it available, that has to be a win for the team, not only just making a new sexy use case or solving some feature in the front end, right?
Yeah.
So you have to get all these incentives up and running. You have to lower their capacity or their workload, on their initial workload, and you have to enable them with resources that can actually do some of these things. And also work closely with the platform team, because I always think that platform should be, you should have the minimal viable platform, and it should be driven by the abstractions that you observe and the actual war stories out in the teams. So if you start doing data mesh and you start to put these data engineers into the teams, they have to start to work together with the platform team to figure out what sort of platform do we need to support this data mesh.
Yeah, there needs to be it's not what do the data engineers want to put into production, it's what do the developers actually want to use, right?
Yeah.
If you don't have that, you're kind of not going to have good adoption. So, but so I also think that we've kind of talked about it a little bit, or we've been circling around it, of like, there are ways to share data that aren't data mesh, right? There are scalable ways. And that's where we need to get to for those small and mid-sized companies, because if you don't have this complexity, but you do need to be able to power those business decisions on a day-to-day basis, whether that's machine learning models or not, we have to get to a framework for doing that. But, you know, I don't think it is, from my conversations with Jamak, she doesn't think it is. It's not data mesh for those small to mid-sized companies, because it's too much to take on versus, hey, we just need to align these cultural aspects and that have that centralized team, but that the centralized team doesn't have to be the one that owns all of the context. They can own the context of how the data is used, but that they enable the application developers, those teams, to easily share their data and to easily think through, hey, are my changes going to break things and what's that going to cause? And that they understand how their data is used, but that they're also not like, you know, I talk about this analysis paralysis of, if you tell application developers in most organizations currently, the way that we have tooling set up, if you tell them that they can't break their data for the downstream consumers, they can't make application schema changes because they don't know what is doing what downstream. There isn't a good way for them to understand that. And so they can't test, they just can't know. And so either they can evolve their application schema or they can't. And their job is to do the right things for the application, which is evolving the schema.
Yeah.
So, and we need to get them to understand what their data model looks like. But, you know, like Flexport, they went and hired analytics engineers and stuck those in their domains. They embedded those in the domains. Most companies don't have the ability to go out and hire a whole bunch of analytics engineers. They don't have that headcount. They can't necessarily even find those people if they did. And so, I think this is important. So
And also in terms of organization, because what we kind of, you touched onto it there in terms of what one company did, right? They did put analysts into their domains. And I think team structure is also a very important key player in data mesh enablement. And as I mentioned to you earlier, I think of data mesh as an extension to service-oriented architecture, or what they might popularly call microservices today. You already have cross-functional teams in charge of business capabilities, and now you want to add more into those capabilities. And for me, that's a really key thing, that is really, really hard to do data mesh if you have a chaotic team structure. Like if you're basically doing all department stuff and you have all this, or you have a low sense of cross-functional teams and all that stuff, it really becomes hard to throw data mesh into that mix. So even if you have a complex domain and all the other drivers and incentives ready and lined up, you have to take into consideration that you can't just throw data mesh at it. If you want to solve this, you have to start looking at how you organize everything.
Yeah. Tin Ha had a great episode, and he had put out an article on 10 reasons you, or 10, you know, signs or whatever, you aren't ready for data mesh. And it's that of, you know, Jamak has talked about this, I've talked about this, of there is prep work that needs to be done, right? You can't just throw something that has this much of collaborative requirements, right? Data mesh is so much about communication and collaboration. And if you don't have an organization that is set up for that collaboration, that's your pre-work. That's your homework. That's the thing you have to do. That's your stretching and your training before you're getting out on the field. Otherwise, you're going out there and you're going to pull a hamstring pretty dang quick, right? Like it's not going to go well if you're not doing that. So, before we jump into that kind of team structure aspect, so we talked about kind of company size and domain complexity. Like, do you have good markers for somebody to really, I mean, I think it's one of those where if people have the company size and the organization size, you know, if you're, a governmental organization or whatever, but that if they're in that boat, they know it, but there are a lot of people who think they're in that boat and they think that the problem is the centralization, when the problem is definitely not the centralization yet, if they had a better kind of structure. So do you have indicators or markers that you would look for somebody being like that data mesh is the fit to do now?
Yeah. Probably I would gather some data on how many data sets are you producing today? I mean, how many domains is within the central ingestion team today? What's their lead time? How are they serving new data needs? I mean, a lot of those that sounds very negative, but a lot of those centralized platforms are focused around Tableau reporting and business reporting, and not necessarily ready to take on machine learning requirements and kind of new data requirements. So I would also look at how does your team respond to new requirements and how do they understand them? Does their models fit with their machine learning requirements? Because machine learning requirements is something different than reporting. I mean, the most complex historization models I've been involved with has something like 4 date dimensions. You have machine learning engineers that want to be able to recreate a data set as it was in any point in time. And that's kind of the most complex things. So yeah, the number of data sets, their lead time, how are they responding to new data? And also I also think it's really interesting to observe the how the collaboration, the current collaboration with the operational team is, or operational teams are, because I mean, do you have a lot of dark data? What's the quality of your data? Is it like just, oh, by the way, can you set up a new integration and you're basically just doing raw ingestion and the analysts are not really taking that data, or they can't really use that data because it's poor quality? It's not like that, it's difficult to understand from a semantical point of view. It's, I mean, how close is it to a data product?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of aspects you can look at, which kind of sums up to like, is your current analytical setup matching your requirements, right?
Is it working? Is it serving your needs?
Is it working? Are you happy?
and nobody's ever happy, right? Like, but how acute is the pain? Like, how strong is this pain? Angelo Martelli kind of talked about this in his episode about proving out that you have a problem. And so, you know, when you think about, okay, what is the amount of time, lead time needed to make a change in your data warehouse?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like 6 to 8 weeks in a lot of cases. And so by the time you've made that change, the change is kind of irrelevant because you have to make the next change. And so like you need that flexibility and, you know, everybody wants everything to be as usable as possible, and Data Mesh is trying to kind of flip that switch a little bit about trying to figure out how we get to usable at the whole enterprise level, which is what the data warehouse is focused on, but that you don't chop off all the context and the actual meaning and everything that goes into doing that centralized data warehouse. Cause you're just like, I have to fit it into this box or into this cookie cutter approach. And so, you know, I'm throwing out 90% of the dough because I just have to have it fit this cookie cutter, and it doesn't matter what the dough was around that cookie cutter. So, okay. I think those are really good ones.
I think I also forgotten to mention the last one, just to reiterate something I mentioned earlier in the podcast. If you're using data, like if you're doing machine learning for operational cases, I don't see how a centralized team doing ETLs after the fact are going to get anything closer than, oh, by the way, are we going to fix it the next day? Or we have to coordinate verbally between teams, which is like the bad perfume of agile, I guess, that you have to, if you have forced coordination between teams, then you're not in a good place. So I think Data Mesh is at least a solution to doing proactive changes. You introduce versioning from the origin, right? So I really can't see how you can solve that if you have business cases which are reliant on having analytical data sets available and up to speed.
Yeah, and I think that ends up being one of those things that I think you're 100% correct. And I think it's something where people misinterpret it and push back on, because they go, oh, so you're saying that Data Mesh is serving the ML use case directly. And it's like, no, but it gets you in the mode of understanding that you have to keep this data, like you said, kind of that proactive change, but that you understand and you take the time to figure out what is this change going to cause for everybody else, right? Yeah. That I'm not in my silo. I'm not just getting to do whatever I want, and it doesn't have any effect on the greater organization. And so you create the ability to create these data sets to create machine learning models, and then you might be serving those not directly from the mesh for like the kind of live operational use case, but you've learned how to deal with that stuff, and you've learned how to do that, and that you have to take care to this, and that you're, so you've built that muscle up, and that you can add additional things and rework ML models much more quickly, because people aren't going and saying, hey, I want this data. And then they look at the data and they go, well, this wasn't in exactly how I wanted it, or I didn't get what I thought I wanted. And that you don't have that ability to go out there and actually kind of what I call data spelunking, of just kind of going out there and finding some data and going, what is this? Is this useful? And being able to figure out, is this useful? Was this a one-off generated thing, you know, from somebody who left and nobody knows what it really is or what it really means, or, you know, the quality level and things like that. So.
And also, I think you kind of kick off the discussion, right? I mean, you kind of, when you tear down the silos and you and these teams, they have to start thinking about each other as customers. I mean, operational teams suddenly have analytical customers. And then, I mean, that starts a really interesting discussion, because then you have to start discussing what kind of data, what kind of data do you guys have? You can start exploring semantics. You can start collaborating in another fashion in terms of just having this wall of confusion, right? You're just shifting it over, and then someone else is working on it. So I really like the engagement that data mesh brings to the table, and it kind of creates new customers to the operational teams.
Yeah. And how do you think about, kind of wrapping that back into the team structure conversation? Yeah. How do you think about actually getting that buy-in from people like on the operational side, on those developers? You know, let's say you can get them to rework the KPIs, the team still gets to kind of prioritize what they want to prioritize. So even if there's something from on high, they don't get to, it doesn't mean that you're going to get what you want. It means that you might get something that conforms to a ticket, but it's not the actual, what you actually want out of it until, you've put in 65 tickets and it's been reprioritized and prioritized across 3 years. So how do you get people like yourself bought in that this is good and useful and it's something they should do? Is that the career angle? Is that it's good for the company and you kind of get that? Is it just like getting the consumers and the producers in the same room? There's just so many different things that have come up, but like, how do you think about getting those people actually bought in?
Yeah, I think you have to listen to them first. I mean, there's going to be an increased cognitive load on that team. And yeah, you can have data engineers and build up the team with more roles, but you're also going to do a few things that's probably going to be more painful for the team. First of all, who's going to do data prioritization? I mean, who's going to do the backlog grooming for the data stuff? I mean, it usually ends up with the product owner, right? You don't want to have two product owners managing the same team. So, or product manager, I don't know what the correct term is, but the guy or girl doing the priorities, right? You want one of them. So that person is going to get more work, I think. And also you can't really get away from the fact that the operational guys and girls, they have to start thinking about how their data changes are going to affect these products they're creating. So you're going to care, either if you start putting other resources into the team, going to have to address the fact that they're going to get more things. They get more things that I have to do and think about. And also, so I think you have to sit down with the team and start thinking, asking the questions, how are we going to address this extra cognitive load? I mean, you don't want to have daily scrums with 15 people, right? Everyone's been there, and it's an absolute nightmare. And especially when you start getting these stand-ups where only the information which is passed on in the stand-up is only relevant for part of the team, right? So I think you have to... I don't have any strong opinion on like the if they do team of teams or if they do how they mix and match this thing to make it work. But I think the point is that you have to get them to accept that beyond the broader team boundary, these things are going to be versions. I don't care how you guys and yours are going to solve it within this boundary. You can do teams of teams. You can do one big team. I don't care. That's up to you guys to figure out. But you're not going to deploy anything into production or anything continuous and break your data products. That's what you have to solve. So I think you have to give them some autonomy in terms of letting them address things that's going to be painful for them in terms of team size. And you have to give them extra resources. You have to reshape the business so that that you get common goals on top. You can't have people that's only cheering for customer experience, right? In the UI and these data needs that are being put on the team, they're just going to go into the backlog and no one really cares. Or there's this data guy up on the side who really wants them to do it, but no one really focuses on it. So you have to reshape the requirements that meet the team. And I also think you need a bit of a whip in terms of you. People don't like to change. I mean, we have this natural resilience towards doing new stuff. So you also have to put some hard requirements in there and say, I'm sorry, guys, but this is for the better good of our business. So we're going to do this. We're going to solve this. And you just have to get on board. And you can give me feedback on what you need, but you can't opt out. You can't jump ship, right? So there has to be some hard boundaries, and then you have to use their competence so they can shape their team solutions in the best way they see fit.
Yeah, and when Jessica Kerr or Jessatron was on, she was talking about she kind of hates the word autonomy versus agency, because autonomy means you go figure it out versus agency is like you have the rights and the permission to choose how you want, but we're going to help you with it. And it's like it becomes this kind of semantical debate around specific wording. But I think that's an approach that seems to be working a little bit better. But I agree with you. Scott Hawkins also talked about as a team that's trying to drive the data mesh, that you can opt out of working with teams if they're being just too painful or whatever. But I agree with you that you don't allow anybody to just say, oh, we're not going to do this.
Yeah.
But you have to work with them to figure out why don't they want to do this, or what is the really big issue with this. And I think a lot of the pushback that I've seen is because data people and the application people just speak such different languages. And so, you know, the number of times that data people talk about pipelines and how crucial pipelines are, it's not the way most application developers think. They don't think of a pipeline. They think of, okay, this is a kind of a job to be done. And it's like, this thing does some data East type stuff, but it's not that I set up a pipeline that does X and Y and Z, you know, that does these transformations in these steps with this. It's like, well, yeah, you just set up the thing to do the thing, right? Yeah. And it's not, you know, talking about something like DBT or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Data people love talking about that, but the application software engineers, they're just like, "What is this? Why do I care? What is this going to let me do?" So,
yeah. And also, one thing I find really interesting when working with data engineers versus programmers is that we all tend to have the golden hammer, right? I mean, the first ingestion ETL thing I ever did, if you had to make a guess, do you think I, A, wrote it in code, or B, used something like Airflow?
Well, I mean, I think everybody starts trying to write it in code and then goes, oh, this was more and more complicated every day. And so I'm trying to cover 17 use cases and it doesn't work. So I'll go find something. But you do code.
Yes, I didn't rewrite Airflow. I mean, I'm too old to do that kind of painful stuff. But I attacked the problem from a coding perspective. I mean, we had data, we had the low quality, so it needed to be cleaned up, and we had to do apply a lot of heuristics to block bad data and do all that stuff. And that's kind of when code shines. Those things are kind of good with code. So I was kind of in luck with doing an ingestion of an external data set in code. But I also got this aha moment that kind of, my background makes me consider code all the time. While if I go talk to data engineers and you ask them about a problem, if they start creating something that looks like a something you would code in a service and drop in a container and deploy, they're automatically thinking about directed asynchronous graphs and ETL jobs and all that stuff. So our backgrounds is like your background really influences what you look at first. And some things are really good with ETL jobs and some things are really good in code. And I hope we can get the discussion going in terms of having a more neutral assessment as to which tools we apply for both problems.
Or that those ETL jobs are in code. Because that's the thing that's scalable. That's the thing that's reviewable. That's the whole issue with so much of this stuff. I talk about the trapped metadata problem, but like that's even how you think about transformations and things like that, is that they're trapped in these different systems and people can't review them or understand them or figure out what's going on here. So you could kick off an ETL job. You know, this is what orchestration does. It's fine to have that, but the coding around it needs to be there. So that way people, it's not, oh, this one person writes with this weird, weird format and nobody can figure out what it means. And so if they leave, we're all screwed. You know, I would say I was really bad about this in my former days when I was doing, you know, kind of financial analysis type stuff. There was one thing that I wrote that had, I think, 32 VLOOKUP statements embedded in one cell. And so it worked perfectly well. It was very, very useful, but VLOOKUPs are also very fragile and things like that. And so it's like, yes, if I'm the one that's doing this and I had to write very, very specific documentation on how to, here's how you insert a new thing and here's how you make sure that you want to insert it in the middle of this grouping. So the grouping will still be there. And because otherwise you're just not going to include this in the broader group of these, you know, 15 different subcategories. And it just, it makes it so that if you're doing these very special one-off type things, you're capable of doing it potentially. You know, there's all the times where people come and look at code and go, I don't know what this is. And I wrote it yesterday. I have no idea what this does. How does this work? So, yeah. And how have you found bridging that language gap works? A lot of people have said, just get people in the room together, but it, you know, that's a one-off potentially of a meeting versus a collaboration going forward. So how have you found that kind of collaboration can be sticky?
Yeah, we haven't gotten to that point yet. So we're kind of in those meeting sessions and kind of the cultural shift. So I'll have to tell you about that some other time. I'm not going to lie. So I don't know. I just kind of see the things. I mean, I've been on the other side so often, so I kind of recognize and I acknowledge what they're fighting what their concerns are, right? So you basically, you just have to work with the tools that I mentioned earlier and we'll take it from there, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that empathy angle is important to go in and say, this person's not trying to break all the stuff, even if if their actions are breaking it, they're not the one that's breaking it. It's that we haven't set up, it's, you know, kind of the blameless postmortem and, you know, something breaks at Amazon and it's not the person who broke its fault. It's the fact that there wasn't enough safeguards to prevent that breakage. We need to build in those safeguards and figure that out and just have empathy that it's not somebody's, you know, the number of times that I've seen a story of an intern going in and dropping the production database. And it was like, why did you give the intern root access to the production database? And there's no safeguard to go, did you really mean to just drop the entire database? Like, what are you doing? That is not that person's fault that they, you fat finger something or you think that you're in test and you're in prod and that it goes, no. Like, did you really mean to do this?
Yeah. But one thing I'm, which I think is really interesting, is that you have. We talked about teams and organizations. That's and things you have to solve in order to be enabled for data mesh. But I also think it's really interesting to look at what kind of systems does your organization provide. I mean, the perfect fit for me would be a operational team that's master of their own domain, right? They're modeling the system. They own the databases. They know every column. They know every aspect of the system. That's kind of the perfect fit, right? In terms of team and technology. Then you have teams working on top of systems that the company's bought, right? And then it's kind of becomes a bit more complicated, or even worse, maybe it's a software as a service solution, which you don't even know how the database looks, and you're getting data. You can support getting some data out of it, but it's kind of you're not masters of the database and how it looks and all that stuff. And then you have the worst category, which are data you buy from other companies, right? And so I think there's like these three different categories of teams and systems. And there's some work really well, and others kind of, yeah, I don't really feel that data mesh answers the question of who does all the heavy lifting if you basically buy a data set from an external source and you have to be the one shaping it into data products for the entire organization. Which is kind of the approach we have taken, where we kind of said you're it, right? So if you're going to buy a data set, an external data set, we have said congratulations, you bought this. Now you have the honor of exposing it to the rest of the organization. So if you're working for a team that's kind of buying a lot of data, you're going to get a lot of jobs owning up to that. So I kind of feel that's not a perfect solution, but it kind of takes at least a job off the central team. But I don't know if you've heard about other strategies towards that kind of problems.
I mean, I've seen this. So I was at a company that did kind of a rather large reorg and then did like 7 subsequent reorgs in the next 6 to 9 months or whatever. There was one person who was just really, really gung-ho, and they'd been previously in support and they were now as a software developer, and they were really gung-ho and they really knew where a lot of the issues were. And so I think they had 8 different managers across 7 months, and he was doing great, great work, but he was, cause he would jump in and be like, I'm going to fix this thing. And he would get like 80% done. And then somebody else would pull him into something that was urgent and stuff. But, you know, what happened was that you kept having these orphaned systems where the person who had created it would leave or would kind of disavow themselves from it, and that it would get pushed under a new team. And it just never really worked. And some of that is you have to really, really encourage very strong documentation. But I mean, I think if you're buying data, I don't understand the concept of not going to the producer, you know, of that data and going, here's how you're going to produce data to me. Right.
Yeah.
How do we not have that power? It's somebody who is you're the customer, and you're saying. Yeah.
I totally agree. But if you knew how many bad companies who sell data that exists out there, you would be amazed. I mean, data quality is a big thing, even if you're buying data from professional data for companies living off that, delivering data. So cleaning data, blocking data from ingestion, and basically sanitizing the models and building your own. I would love to go to those companies and say, hey, I'm the customer, give me this and this and this. But until that day comes, we have to do some trade-offs. Yeah.
Yeah. Those companies just confuse me that they just don't have usable APIs and things. It's like, how are you not thinking about, like, it's kind of like, you're a data producer and you're just producing into the void and going, who wants to buy it? Versus like, I'm going to have a conversation with my consumers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we talked, you know, in and around team structures, but is there anything else that you wanted to cover kind of on team structures or?
I think we pretty much covered it. If you don't have any ideas.
Yeah. Well, and you had wanted to also talk about kind of the generally the elephant in the room in data mesh, which is the federated computational governance that it's, yeah. It's a massive topic. I hate governance simply because governance shouldn't be a single topic, right? It's 15 subtopics all rolled up underneath each other. And then when you think about in data mesh, it's not just the kind of gatekeeper role. It's not that centralized governance that everything flows through. It's that centralized governance as the enabler for teams to handle their own stuff. And then you add in the computational aspect of that governance of adding policy to the data and flowing that policy with the data, as well as the governance around how data is created so that you manage the complexities of cost management to make sure that you're not just saying, oh, we're going to produce this data and it doesn't matter what it costs, because it obviously does. There's an investment to be had for the return. So it just becomes this big morass. And I think it's a big, big pain point for a lot of people to start heading down that path. And my kind of proof of concept of advice is kind of CYA, which cover your butt, we'll call it, just so that I can maintain the non-explicit thing on the podcast. But like, it is such a difficult topic of about how much do you focus on value maximization versus, you know, how much you have to put in the right amount of effort to make sure you don't get yourself into trouble. And if you inform your teams as to, hey, here are dragons, let me know when you're headed down that path towards dragons and we'll team together, and that it's not, hey, I want access to this data. What is this data? It's like, okay, this person wants access. I'm not sure because of X or Y or Z. What are your thoughts? And that there's like a very specific ask instead of this person wants access, yay or nay, that there's like more of that specific communication back and forth. But, you know, I just said a whole lot of things at you about governance, but like, where do you think, where are you not as happy with what's been put out there, or where do you think that we need more focus on, or what's kind of your big issue with kind of that federated computational governance angle?
Yeah. I mean, my issue with it is that I think we have to simplify stuff, because we tend to forget that developers are a very, very large mass of different people with different skills. And I've seen this kind of academic story being played out before. I mean, you can read the, I think his name was Eric Evans. He wrote a book on domain-driven design. And it's kind of, it's a bit too academic, so that kind of you end up with a lot of developers missing like key points, like an aggregate is actually a protection of invariant and use cases. It's not a classification of an entity. I mean, that's one of the most important parts of domain-driven design. And if you make things too complex, people just kind of forget those problems and they end up with doing the wrong thing. And I also seen it with service-oriented architecture, where there was this big debate for like 10-15 years about what does it mean. And there was, I mean, it went from people talking about technology, oh, it's web services, right, to people talking about concepts. And like Udi Dahan was one of the main advocates of the thing, which I mean is data mesh today. And then they kind of gave up and like said, okay, we're never going to agree what service-oriented architecture is. So we're going to create this new word. We're going to call it microservices, and we're going to describe a few aspects, which is more to the point. So I guess what I'm a bit concerned is that if we start throwing around really, really, really complex stuff like computational federated governance, there's a big risk that you're going to end up with a lot of enforcers that's going to stake their claim and say that, yeah, we know data mesh, but they really don't know what they're talking about, right? I mean, it gets too complex. So we have to simplify things and get more into the practical. We have to bridge the gap between the, it's next two very, very excellent articles, but they need more examples in terms of what does this mean in a more simplified language, I guess.
Yeah, decompose, 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 because I think exactly what you're talking about and what I mentioned is that, you know, governance is really, to me, it's like 15, 17 subtopics. And so it kind of had to be under one pillar because people were, you know, were asking Jamak about, okay, but how do we do governance? How do we do governance? And but there are a lot of aspects to this. And Mohammed Syed was on recently on his episode on governance, and I'm going to be digging a lot deeper into it with a lot of folks coming up. But it's a big challenge simply because the way that we've done governance in the past has been at the very macro organizational level type of thing. And we need to decompose governance to be at the micro level around each data product in and of itself. And within that, we need to make it so developers have the ease to go, okay, I'm going to mark this as PII or potentially PII and whatever. And then the data product owner can, you know, say, okay, here's our masking rules around it. And there can be centralized masking rules that then can be click button applied, right? And here is that enablement, right? And it's the same thing when you think about interoperability of we need those centralized standards from the governance team to push that out. And the teams can say, okay, one thing we don't want to head down with data mesh is just data silos everywhere. But it's fine to me to have a data product that isn't interoperable with anything else, or at least a table within a data set that isn't interoperable because it is of value in and of itself. And so you don't have to say everything has to be interoperable with everything else, because then that again breaks the ability to maximize your context. And so local maximization versus global maximization of value of, I don't want to fully maximize the value of every single data product, because if I'm doing that, then the global maximum of my data goes down significantly because there's not that interoperability between domains. We start to think about ML and pulling things in from lots of different places. But what I've been talking about as well is to do governance right in data mesh, you need to expose the concepts and the decision-making to the domains. And Mohammed said this really well of to federate governance, you need to have, or to just do data governance in general, you need to have informed governors. So if you're federating governance, you need to inform those governors and you need to enable them to do their job around governance easily. And that's not exposing the tools and, you know, having a developer have to learn all of the AMI rules or whatever and stay up to date on those. But that there is kind of a checklist of here's what we're trying to accomplish. Hey, central team, here's what we're trying to accomplish. Did we do it? Or, you know, did you expose this to us in a, it's the same thing with self-serve, right? You're not exposing DBT to folks, you're exposing them the ability to write their code. There's a company called the Meraxa that's I think doing some interesting stuff around this about how they're exposing the creation and orchestration of pipelines and things like that, but in software developer workflows and language, and that you think about who's using this and why, and that you don't say everybody has to know everything about everything versus people aren't dumb, right? You don't hire dumb people. I mean, we all sometimes make those hiring mistakes, but we won't go down that route. But you know, we have to trust these people that they're going to make good decisions and do right and that. But we have to enable them to be able to actually make those decisions. And so, much easier said than done. And exactly what you said of like, let's get super specific. Like, let's get those people talking about, it's kind of the same thing with data discovery, where data discovery is just this huge topic to me because it's like, can I find the data? Well, what does find mean? Like, yeah. Is it, okay, I can find that there is data here, but can I understand what it is? Can I get access to it? Can I, you know, actually use it? Can, is, you know, and people start to talk way too much, I think, about performance. And I really hate the idea of people talking way too much about performance, but it does matter relative to this. And, you know, somebody was asking, I think on Twitter about the, how do you do, like, how do you think about data products in different countries and doing like a cross country query? Do you copy that same data everywhere around? And so that you've got that kind of central data product, and then you've got all the other places where they are copies, and that copy is, you know, the speed of light. So whoop-de-doo, it's not that difficult to keep that updated. But so that way people can do easy, quick queries, or, you know, and then that starts to get into the governance too of data sovereignty issues. And like, I mean, it just ends up being very, very complicated. And so yeah. Where I tell people is to not get that bogged down. You again, you cover your butt, right? You make sure you're not putting yourself into a really bad spot, and you work towards those things, and you work towards, hey, it's the same thing with building the platform. You think about, can we have 80% coverage so that this is the easy and the right path? And then we deal with the other 20% when we have to, but we're not trying to cover everything, but we're also not saying you go deal with it. Right? Because if it's you go deal with it, you're, it's way too much toil. It's way too much repetition of work. So,
It was really interesting when you gave the example about masking, because I've really never thought about masking as a governance, like a centralized governance feature. I mean, I always thought that if you have a team that's experts on a domain and they have sensitive data, it's like within their domain expertise to do masking and that kind of things to, because they know their data, right? So it was really interesting to like hear that you thought about that from a governance perspective, like you could actually provide that kind of features to the team, right?
Yeah, you're putting in your columns and you just have a, is this PII? Check, yeah, right? Like that column has PII in it. Okay, yeah. Boom, it's masked. Yeah. And then you can start to say, do you want to create, you know, auto rules so people can access this automatically? But like access by default, you have to have that masking, and you don't want to have, okay, I'm putting out my first iteration of this data product. Okay, there's this stuff in there that could be useful, but like I'm going to mask these eight columns, and then you go out and you talk to people and none of those eight columns get used. Okay, I can remove that. Like, this is awesome. I don't even have to deal with this stuff, and I can have this access by default. But like, it's all about what can we automate from a toil perspective so that somebody doesn't have to create that masking, and that there is a common user experience. I go from this product to this product, and I want to request access to these masked columns. I don't want to have to learn that this person created this crazy UX for how they do this. And it's totally, you know, my UX is totally different than your UX is totally different than, you know, Sally's UX. And so like it becomes that empathy for the user as well. And so how do we do that? Oh, yeah. Like it's something that it's far easier said than done. And it's not something that I came up with. It's the conversations that I've had that people say this stuff, but
yeah, because this is like, I mean, governance to me has been like, putting up a Confluence page and describing, oh, by the way, you have to name your stuff like this and this, and you have to adhere to these date standards, and you have to use ISO 8602 for dates and all that stuff, and basically just describing formatting and stuff like that. And then I kind of I've been thinking a lot about how can you do security, like how can you have a centralized security model which you can enforce locally, so that you can have these centralized concept, but you can have team ownership and team appliance and that kind of stuff. So you don't end up with having a platform team doing data security on all the data sets for all the teams, because then you're basically putting business capabilities back into the platform team again. So, I mean, and that's kind of just an example of things I've been thinking and grappling with, and you're kind of coming from a completely different angle. So I just love it.
Well, but there are tools that are doing that, like Okera, Muta are all trying to do that. But it's exactly what you talked about as well, of that's not their domain. They don't know what that data really is. So they don't know, okay, yes, I shouldn't just give everyone access to the email column. That's not good. Unless it's it's internal folks and people need it for, creating a mailing list or whatever. But yeah. That's PII. That's not good to expose. But there's all sorts of things, somebody on talking about kind of in the medical field, that there are things that you can back into who is the person that this is about if you have like just four or five attributes. In the US, yeah. If you have somebody's date of birth and their zip code, I think are the only two things. And it might even be like birthday and not even the year, but I think it's date of birth and their zip code. You have 84% coverage of who this person is. It's something insane where you can back into who is this exact person. I think there might be a third one of like their first name or something like that. But like it's just... you're able to back into that PII and that's highly regulated of figuring out who exactly this is about from those things. So it's pretty crazy where you've got to have that training and you've got to enable them to do it, but you've got to make it so that it's not toil work, right? Like the more that people have to do repetitive, dumb stuff, right? Yeah. Like building masking is a solved problem. Don't resolve it.
Yeah. But how are we going to do that in terms of, we talked a lot about data sets, but you can have data products being something entirely different, right? You can have streams, you can have APIs. Maybe you're doing data products as an API as well. And then I think it becomes interesting because if you have a centralized pipeline, which you kind of supports masking, which you can publish your data sets to, and it goes through some sort of process which does all those things. What about a data API, which comes from, maybe you're hosting it just by besides your other APIs? The teams are like, they have a team, you have an API for your front end solutions and you have an integration APIs. And by the way, here is my data API, the same team, right? So, I mean, those kind of solutions for doing masking and all is, yeah, I'm curious because I'm curious as to how that works cross technology.
Yeah, right? I'm trying to get the idea of kind of a API gateway for data, right? Because data APIs are different and they're very different. And a lot of people who are like, what? An API is an API. And it's like, no, an API for one side is not the same as an API for the other. But like that we can make those extensible. And again, that common user experience is also part of the governance umbrella of make it so that people can, Zalando, Max Schulte has talked about this, but they have all of their stuff is basically stored in S3 buckets and accessed via APIs. And so you have to have those same kind of APIs and exactly what you talked about of, hey, here's the extensible API. We're going to create this and that you can do these things on top of it. And here's how you do X and Y and Z. And those are the common things that you need to do of access and also moving with the policies with the data and things like that. So I don't think we're there yet. I think it's something that some companies are doing pretty good work there, but I think it is still also all custom built and we need more people sharing kind of, hey, here's this thing that we're trying or here's this thing that we tried and it didn't work. And so here's this thing that we got to that did work. So like those types of things. So, But we're well past an hour now. So this has been awesome. So I really, really appreciate it. Is there anything we didn't cover that you wanted to cover that we could, touch on for a minute or two, or are you ready to?
I have 1,000 more questions and things. So I think if we just start, we're going to sit here for 2 or 3 hours. So maybe we can just talk some other time. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that sounds great. So, Marius, this has been really great. Where can people find you online if they want to continue the conversation? And what do you want people reaching out to you about? Whether that's to ask you questions or to tell you what they're doing or things like that.
Yeah, I basically love talking about anything. I mean, I love sharing the fact that we don't have all the answers and that we can discuss different problems that we have. So it can be anything from people having something that they want to pair it with someone, basically just to discuss some problems, or maybe they have some sort of solution to something that we have addressed in this talk. So it can be anything. Yeah.
Okay. And best place to get in touch with you, LinkedIn or?
Yeah, probably LinkedIn. Yeah. Or I regularly write a few posts on, if people want to look at more about my technical stuff, I do some writing on Medium. So I do some rants on the things that I figure out when, and some of them are probably relevant. So.
as always, I'll drop those links in the show notes. So, but Marius, this was a really great conversation. I think it'll be helpful for a lot of folks. So, thank you so much for your time, and thanks everybody for listening. I'd again like to thank my guest today, Marius Inger, who is a developer turned senior consultant at the extremely Norwegian named company Nerkfrit AS. Or links to his LinkedIn and Medium are in the show notes as per usual. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Data Mesh Radio. Hopefully it was useful to you. If you'd like to connect with the show, you can find us on LinkedIn or Twitter. If you'd like to connect with me, you can do the same. If you have feedback, or especially if you'd like to be a guest, we've got some links in the show notes to tell you how to do that. I'd love to hear what questions people have and how I can be useful. And then this is provided as a free community resource by DataStax. So please do stick around after the music if you'd like to hear more about what DataStax is offering with their serverless managed version of Cassandra. Data Mesh Radio is a free community resource provided by DataStax. If you're not aware, I'm actually employed by DataStax, and they've allowed me to be a resource for the general data community, learning about data mesh, data as a product, and other related topics. If you're not aware, DataStax has made a lot of pretty big, interesting changes in the last few years. They now offer a multi-region, very performant, serverless database offering with a number of easy-to-develop-for APIs with like gRPC, JSON, GraphQL, REST. You know, if you'd like to learn more, check them out. You can check out their AstraDB offering, and you can use the code DAAP500. That's DAAP500. Or data as a product 500 to get $500 of free credits. You can also check out what they're doing with streaming. It's pretty interesting.